We talk Victor Wembanyama with noted Spurs fan Shea Serrano, and we tell you who are the 10 most interesting players in the Western Conference right now on this episode of No Cap Room. Hello, friends. Welcome back to No Cap Room. My name is Jake Fisher. I am a senior NBA reporter at Yahoo Sports. Joining me, as always, senior NBA writer for Yahoo Sports, it is my man, your man, everyone's man, Dan Devine. What's up?
I've been thinking a lot about whether or not it's good to be everyone's man. I guess it's better than being no one's man, but I'm kind of like, is that overextending myself or overpromising that I can be all things to all people, Jake? This is the stuff that I worry about when we're between episodes.
Well, I think if you are your man, that essentially opens
my
you
own
up
man.
To being, well, your Twitter handle is your man Devine.
This
correct?
Is true. Accurate.
So usually we save that tease for afterwards for the, right. For the exit.
Spoiler alert, it'll be the same by the end of the show.
If you are your man to the proverbial you, technically that is everyone. So you kind of did it to yourself.
It's true. I mean, and we've been working through a lot of big feelings and big thoughts. The idea that you're complicit in your own problems, it's hard to take responsibility and accountability sometimes. But, you know, we're just going to strive to be better, going to do the best that I can with this episode moving forward. To try to be all things to all people, because that's the promise that I've made to you, the listening public.
Well, stay tuned for another mention of Dan's Twitter handle, and also stay tuned for an exclusive conversation between Dan Devine and one Shea Serrano, who needs no introduction. But first, the NBA season is right around the corner. It has never been a better time to sign up for Yahoo Fantasy Basketball with some buddies or even strangers. Draft your league at yahoofantasy.com in the Yahoo Fantasy app. It's a great app. Didn't have waiver wire issues like another fantasy app did today. But all right,
not naming any names, not pointing any fingers, just noting the quality of the Yahoo Fantasy app.
Listen, I will say the group chat buddies, the Philly group chat Sixers fan friends who are definitely losing their minds about the latest seesaw of the James Harden stuff that we will not really be getting into on today's episode. They are all in a Yahoo Fantasy Football League that we've been in since 2011. The app has been tried and true. I can only recommend it on the basketball side as well. But to business. Last week, we discussed 10 of our most interesting players from the Eastern Conference in no particular order. We're doing the same for the Western Conference. And we got some pretty good feedback from some people that liked our format. So we're going to try to do it again. We're going to try to step it up and keep bringing intriguing, maybe names you weren't expecting. Because, like, honestly, I was looking at this. We had to get one Lakers player in here. And my first inclination was to be LeBron. Because let's just be honest, that is the most interesting player on the Lakers. But... to go a little bit deeper, to go to the levels of analysis and information that the NC Armada is accustomed to on this program. The name I put is not LeBron. It is not Anthony Davis. It is not Austin Reeves. It is D'Angelo Russell. And I'm curious just for your first reaction, and then I'll explain to you why I put him down on my list.
Yeah, my reaction is... He was considered to be like the biggest piece that they acquired at the trade deadline in February when they sort of remade their roster, sending out Russell Westbrook and kind of bringing in like half of a new rotation. And then by the end of the postseason, he was kind of in and out of the lineup. He was kind of hit or miss in terms of when they were, you know, who you were looking for to be that floor spacer, to be the complimentary playmaker. He got really supplanted in the hierarchy there by Austin Reeves. I mean, maybe that was always going to happen because that's sort of where Reeves was targeted from the beginning of from when they made that deal. But you wound up at the end of the postseason wondering, like, is he part of their long-term plans? So they bring him back, not on a long-term deal, you know, 2-year deal. And he's going to be, my guess is, vying for minutes with Gabe Vincent, who's there, and playmaking opportunities with Reeves and with the rest of that sort of backcourt mix. Yeah, I can see the argument for it. I want to hear from you though. Like, what about that really stood out to you?
The contract stuff was interesting at that point last season you're talking about, because I do feel there was some games where I forget what the injury was, but he was missing a couple games here and there. And there was definitely some whispers around Lakers land that, like, oh, maybe if he had an extension done, he'd be playing right now.
Ah.
So the contract stuff's out of the way. Austin Reeves got paid. Rui got paid. Most of this team got paid. Gabe Vincent comes from Miami on a much bigger deal than what the Heat were willing to be offering him. So there's just a lot of mouths to feed in the ball handling aspect. Usually we talk about mouths being fed from like a scoring standpoint, but there's a lot of dudes on this team who like to have the ball between their fingertips making plays. D'Angelo Russell certainly is one of them. I think one of the biggest issues he had in being a piece of all that puzzle that Minnesota was trying to figure out with Rudy Gobert last season was just using that high screen to step into pull-up jumpers and nothing more. So he's talked about Derek White being this defensive emulation he's trying to follow up. Never seen that in his career. I mean, we've just never seen D'Angelo Russell be a true threat on that side of the ball. And I wonder with Darvin Ham's tendencies to play multi-guard lineups with Gabe being involved, how long does D'Lo kind of position himself above Gabe Vincent in that rotation? And does that depth, you know, the Lakers certainly fancy themselves as one of the Western Conference contenders. Denver and Phoenix, you know, there's a lot of question marks. Calvin Booth will be very confident in the rookies and the young players being able to come on and step up and do that. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But I think the Lakers' depth in theory could be one of their greatest strengths in this contested Western Conference. And I wonder just how much depth they'll have depending on how consistent D'Angelo Russell is, especially now that he got a little bit of a payday that he was kind of hoping for. So that is that, Dan. I'm curious.
Before we jump on, I want to move forward from it. That quote is really interesting to me. You mentioned the Derek White component to it. This is from Jovan Buha and Jay King at The Athletic. Quote, last year they found a way to get me off the floor by not playing defense, I guess, Russell said. So try to be a reason to eliminate that, not give them a reason to not have me on the floor. Try to be as dangerous as I can on offense and try not to be a liability on defense. So it's interesting. It's kind of rare that you see a guy who's this deep into his career. I believe he's 27 going out, you know, going to be 28 soon. Gotten, you know, through several contracts and then being like, well, the issue is I got to now D up. Like, I got to improve on defense. Now that I've been paid, it's about locking in on defense. But this is also the time in a guy's career where you say, like, what matters now, he's not going to be an all-star again. He's not going to be somebody who's vying for all NBA berths or anything like that. The next thing is you need to be consistently a part of a playoff team and you need to be consistently competing for championships. Like, that's the accolade that's next for a guy like D'Angelo Russell. And I think that's very smart to look at it and say, with this head coach, I'm not going to play if I don't play defense. If I'm going to be targeted and a liability, they're not going to keep me out there. So, you know, whether that actually pans out remains to be seen. But you don't necessarily see a whole lot of guys this deep into a career that's made this much money decide that now they're going to lock down. You know, now we find out if the actions meet the words. I think that's kind of interesting. For me, yeah, I mean, it's funny because you have really, you know, you have some interesting players in this list. I'm excited to go through it. I went chalk on a lot of this, man.
You did. You went very chalk.
And so some of it ties into stuff that I'm writing for all this week. I'm doing five most interesting teams columns. And one of them, I just went up yesterday, was the New Orleans Pelicans. It's Zion to me. I mean, I can be too cute about this, but this is a player who, when he has been on the floor, has been an all-NBA caliber centerpiece, the kind of guy that everything can revolve around on offense. The last time we saw him, the first 35 or 36 games of last season, he was making strides on the defensive end of the floor. The Pelicans were a top 10 defense up at the top of the Western Conference. He gets hurt again. He misses the back half of the season again. They wind up washing out before the playoffs again. And his name is in trade rumors this summer. You know, how seriously, it depends on who you listen to, but he's starting that 5-year Supermax extension. And they need him, especially with all the other injury issues that they've had around that roster. You know, Brandon Ingram missing time last season, CJ McCollum struggling with injuries last year. Right now, you've got Trey Murphy III had the meniscus surgery. He's going to be out the start of the season. Larry Nance and Jose Alvarado were dinged up. Najee Marshall is also, hurt his knee. You need your stars to stabilize and to carry you. And that's who's... We need to find out if that's really who Zion can be. Everything that the Pelicans want to try out, Zion at the point, Zion at the five, spreading the floor with Zion as a screen and roll hub, all this kind of stuff. Zion facility. The commonality is you got to have Zion out there. Like they're not like Brandon Ingram has shown he can be an all-star caliber player without Zion. CJ McCollum is a guy that can carry a scoring load, but none of this makes sense without Zion. The thing I keep going back to, and I mentioned it in the piece that I wrote, heading into last season, the Nuggets had only seen their core, Nikola Jokic, Jamal Murray, Aaron Gordon, Michael Porter Jr., for I believe it was 117 minutes. And so the question was like, how much can you believe in such a small sample? They decided they believed in it. They doubled down on it. They won the whole thing.
Are you talking about religion or NBA team building?
I mean, find me the difference between them based on the way that people talk about it, right? Front office executives and scouts and roster managers of all kinds.
For fans,
sure. You know, it's a religion of a whole different level. but if you've got, so that small sample, that belief led one way. Zion Williamson, Brandon Ingram, and CJ McCollum have only been on the floor together for 172 minutes over the course of their time together. They've been plus 60 in those minutes. They've shot the lights out. They've scored like gangbusters. Can you believe in what that showed you? The only way that you can, I think, is if you keep Zion on the floor. So that's the gap. Are you a top of the West vying for home court? Or are you a team that just cannot get it together and come the end of the season has to consider alternate futures? It's about as wide a gap in potential outcomes as I think there is in the conference. So it's not as clever, but I think it's a kind of a big one.
You know, I think the trade stuff that you mentioned, never bought much of that to be so serious. Like teams are going to call and be like, hey, can we get Zion?
Can we get him for a pick? You know, can we get him for our outgoing salary?
With all the stuff with the Portland flirtation, like, yeah, New Orleans really liked Scoot and they were trying to figure out ways to get to number three. But it's kind of been wrung out in the laundry over many of host Damian Lillard trade articles. Like, it just didn't really seem like Portland was going to trade that number three pick unless someone with like obvious, like Zion wasn't going to be the guy anyway. And why would the Pelicans have done that trade also? Like, the number three pick isn't worth the ceiling that guy's worth. So it's just, that stuff, I think, was just internet fodder more than anything else. I think what's been plenty of internet fodder that I alluded to earlier this week was Calvin Booth's comments to Kevin O'Connor on The Ringer, which I personally didn't have a problem with. I think ultimately, if I could be like far too candid here, and I'm saying this to the people who work in the NBA who listen to our show, as well as you, Dan, and everyone else listening, we need more executives speaking candidly on the record.
Right.
That's just going to be a better overall situation for everybody. Second of all, we live in such a time, especially in the NBA, which is just crazy to me, that like our culture is wanting to be outraged at all times. And if Calvin Booth thinks Peyton Watson could be better than Bruce Brown, then like maybe he is. And if he is, then holy hell, Denver's going to be pretty damn good because they just won the title and Bruce Brown was like their third best player most consistently. So Peyton Watson is the next guy I have on my list just because even before that stuff came out from Kevin and set the internet ablaze, I think that's been a big talking point around Denver. I mean, even throughout last season, you know, someone even jokingly texted me when I asked them who I should be, this is the type of research I do, Dan. I was asking people who I should be putting on my list. Some guy jokingly said Colin Gillespie, but like in seriousness, Denver's had the stable of young players that hasn't necessarily played for them that they're thinking already. And as good as Christian Brown was for them last season in the postseason, Peyton Watson's a huge, huge, long athlete that could potentially guard multiple positions and just have a physical, you know, greater potential of impacting things. I haven't seen Peyton Watson play basketball. I don't watch college basketball anymore. I have no idea how good this guy. I've seen a couple of clips from preseason. I got no clue how good he is. But if he's as good as people around the Nuggets and some of my friends in the Denver media have been saying they think he is. I mean, I remember when I went to Denver for game 5 after Phoenix came back, rattled off two straight, tied it 2-2. There was all this talk, oh, Maybe Peyton Watson's going to play tonight. Maybe he'll be this big X factor in this series. It didn't end up playing. The Nuggets steamrolled Phoenix in those next two. They steamrolled the Lakers in the Western Conference Finals, and they basically steamrolled Miami. But again, a lot of that was because Bruce Brown. Not, I mean, a good portion of the contributions Bruce Brown
made. Yeah,
there was
this tall Serbian dude that was kind of involved in some of that as well.
So what the hell is Peyton Watson going to be? I got no idea, but I'm so interested to find out.
Yeah, and you know, you're right. There's the aspect of a, you know, a mystery to it, because he played, let me find the number here. He played 186 minutes during the regular season and 14 during the playoffs, which, quick mental math, that's 200 total minutes during his rookie season.
Good job by you.
Thank you very much. Word guy more than math guy, but here we are on the fly. But you're absolutely right. When, you know, being around, you know, traveling with that series, there was so much chatter among the Nuggets people and among the media where, like, that they were ready for that guy to sort of see more of an opportunity, but just in the crucible of that postseason and where Michael Malone saw their rotation sort of tightening it up the way that he did, weren't minutes there. There was basically one open spot for a young guy. Christian Brown seized that during the season. That kind of that was that. With Bruce Brown being gone, everybody has tapped Christian Brown to be sort of the next man up there, a worthwhile replacement. But you are zagging, which I appreciate and respect, by saying, no, it's not the guy. It's the guy behind the guy. That's who I want to be focusing on. And there's an argument for it. 6'8" swingman with 7 foot plus wingspans who can guard multiple positions. And
they really like wingspan in Denver.
They do. I mean, there's a lot to like about that kind of physical profile. And if you earned the kind of trust that he did during the regular season last year with his work ethic to sort of put yourself in that position, you're going to get minutes. You're going to get an opportunity. And then, if he can cement himself in that rotation role like Brown did last year, that sort of, this is part of that transition period now for Denver, where you move on from Bruce Brown, you move on from Jeff Green, more minutes for Christian Brown, more minutes for Watson. You know, Julian Strother, people are in love with that after his preseason. You know, the rookies that they brought in, Hunter Tyson, Jalen Pickett, there's going to be more opportunity. Colin Gillespie, as you mentioned, those guys are going to get their chances, but Watson absolutely appears to be at the front of the line there, and there's a lot to like.
So from another inside baseball pick of mine, give me one of your another chalk silly answers. I'm just
kidding. Here's a real sicko's delight. Have you heard of a man named Chris Paul?
I have not. Please enlighten me upon the artist.
The twin brother named Cliff.
That guy. Okay.
Oh, that guy. Yeah. He sells insurance. Likes to hit guys in the junk. It's Chris Paul traded to the Golden State Warriors. Actually traded twice. Traded to the Wizards and then from the Wizards to the Warriors in the Jordan Poole deal. I don't want to put too fine a point on it and say, like, this is his last chance. I don't think that's fair. I don't think that's reasonable. Chris Paul is probably going to be able to play until Chris Paul decides he is done. Like, the mind, the shooting, everything, the components that go into making him such an important player, even, you know, this deep into his career. There's a sort of a disconnect in terms of where the Warriors maybe stand in our evaluation, in our estimation, and what they were by the end of last season. By the end of that series against the Lakers, it was like, if Steph can't shake loose, there's nothing. There was like no real, there was very little else that was working there. And some of that was, you know, Klay Thompson just ran out of gas. It was his first full season after multiple seasons lost to leg injuries. He was great during the regular season. He played a huge role for them in the second half, but really ran out of gas, was just short on everything in the playoffs. There was no game six Klay hero shots. It was, he wasn't where he needed to be. You know, Andrew Wiggins has been a very important player for the team the last few postseasons, but also missed a ton of time last season. There wasn't that cohesion. Draymond Green's not going to turn it back to like 2016 game seven and score 35 for you anymore. There needs to be some other source of sustainable offense when Stephen Curry's off the floor, and also a way to generate good looks for other players when he's, you know, when a team is sitting on all the Steph stuff. If you're able to deal with him off the ball, if you're able to, you know, shut down some of the catch and shoot stuff that he's able to do, all that kind of stuff, you need another pathway. Chris Paul represents the best opportunity for that pathway that they've had. I think, I mean, obviously it's not Kevin Durant, but it's more in line with in the way that I'm thinking of it, like Sean Livingston or David West in those second units, where it was like, somebody needs to organize this and somebody needs to run our stuff and find us good things when Steph's not available. So that part, what the second unit looks like, how the offense works when Steph's off the floor, I find particularly interesting. dynamics wise, there's also like, if Draymond Green's going to miss some time at the start of the season, we've seen a lot of Jonathan Kuminga this preseason. He's an X factor that I sort of, that I considered in this way too, but is Paul going to wind up starting? Is he going to wind up? I mean, there's still that open question of like, he seems, has seemed comfortable with the idea, or increasingly comfortable with the idea of coming off the bench. But if Draymond's not there, maybe he doesn't. We've also been hearing a lot about like, oh, Steph's are up. Clay's going to guard power forwards. And why would he guard power forwards unless you're going to have a third guard in there, right? So there are questions to me about what the start of the season looks like, how the rotation shakes out, what role Paul plays, and when he sort of recedes. Like, he's too smart not to see the best way for this all to work. He's also too proud to maybe just get there right away. But I think that the opportunity is there for him to transition into a role where he's exactly the kind of thing that they were missing, and also to maybe preserve his body enough during the regular season with fewer minutes and a smaller role to, you know, be there when it matters, which is something he hasn't really been able to do a whole heck of a lot in the postseason over the last handful of years.
Yeah, one of my first thoughts when the trade went down, but my first thought when I got a tip that Jordan Poole was about to get traded for Chris Paul was, whoa, I got to tweet this out. But my second thought was, this might extend Chris Paul's career, like, if he's not on the ball, to kind of your point about his body. So, yeah, it will be very fascinating to see, after all the talk and who's starting and blah, 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 like, come February, where that thing will really stand. Especially, I mean, they also, let's be real, they really acquired Chris Paul for the playoffs. And we'll see what, and the Warriors are very notorious for using the regular season as an experimentation for what can work in the playoffs. So that, to me, is when my eye will be most trained on the CP3 Golden State dynamic, because they barely got by Sacramento in game 7 of the first round, and they had to go to 7 games against the Lakers. So clearly this is a team that, while still dynastic, they are grasping at the final glimmers of the daylight that is their sun on the horizon of their championship days here. Because you got young teams like the Kings and Houston and OKC. Those are my teasers for what's to come. And with Sacramento, you know, I went out there last fall and I hung out with the team and I spent some time with De'Aaron Fox and Domantas Sabonis to really kind of highlight this next iteration of, you know, from the Daryl Morey tree comes Monty McNair, and it doesn't really matter who the all-stars are. You just got to get two of them, maybe three, and put them together and see how it works. The third guy, they didn't sign in free agency. They didn't trade for, like, Domantas Sabonis. It's Keegan Murray, who they took number four. Number four overall, when a lot of people around the league would have taken and did kind of chastise them or even laugh at Sacramento for taking Keegan Murray over Jaden Ivey, who went fifth at Detroit that year. Keegan Murray was freaking good for Sacramento as a rookie. And if you talk to people around Sacramento, if you talk to rival personnel, Keegan Murray is the swing piece for how good this team can be. You know, a lot of people will look at Sacramento and think, you know, that three seed might have been a little bit fluke. Mike Brown comes in preaching defense and they become one of the greatest offensive teams in NBA history. Like, can that really be sustainable? Well, you can have a 6'10 two-way forward who can shoot threes and handle and pass, which is kind of, that's the next step. You know, Keegan was more of just an ancillary piece, flying around screens, being a spot-up guy off of those De'Aaron Fox, Domas, lefty-lefty pick-and-roll action. Like, can he become more of a hub of everything? Can he be someone who just recreates all the connectivity playmaking out of a big man that Domas does when Domas goes to the bench? I don't know exactly what I'm expecting to see from him. I'm just expecting to see more, and I'm expecting him to see, or to just exhibit, a greater kind of like dominance. Not saying this Keegan Murray is going to go out and dominate the league and be an all-star, but there's a difference between being good and being someone who's like, I'm going to go out here and exert my will on this game. And that's what everyone around him is kind of whispering in his ear. That's what the Kings want. And I'm very curious to see how he can live up to that task.
Yeah. When they drafted him, my first thought, and even like through much of last season, was like, oh, they got on, like, a plan for life after Harrison Barnes. Like, they got a new Harrison Barnes. His name is Keegan. And during the course of the regular season, that, you know, combo forward who hits spot up threes at a really high clip and doesn't make a lot of mistakes, was like, yeah, no, that's perfect. That's kind of exactly what you're hoping for in that role. But the word out of Sacramento all last season was like, no, he's got more to his game than that. There's more to him than that. And then I wrote about this sort of over the summer when we were looking at like players who proved they're too good for summer league really quickly. He had that like kind of one cameo in summer league. And it was just like the mandate in that California Classic was hunt your shot, like go do like try to create run, pick and roll, put it up, you know, get him up. And he two appearances was just like, it was 29 points against the Warriors and 41 on the Heat. Like he was just like shoot, 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 shoot. And he was doing it really efficiently and creating off the dribble. Whether that's something that you like want to have as a primary feature of your offense when you've got De'Aaron Fox and Domantas Sabonis, I don't, you know, that remains to be seen. But knowing that it's there and that he, you know, that you can, when you've given him the opportunity to do it and he's shown like, oh yeah, I can shoulder a little bit more here. I can take on more of a playmaking burden, maybe up the usage, maybe up the field goal attempts, maybe up the time of possession. That's like that's a really important growth spot. Cause you're like the big takeaway with the Kings was like, everybody was healthy all last season. They had the best injury luck in the West or among it. And that's why they were able to rise up so high. How do you counteract some regression to the mean in terms of injury absences or whatever? You need more growth from the guys that are on board. And Keegan Murray going from like nice complimentary, our new Harrison Barnes to somebody more than that would be a huge way for them to do it. Next for me is again, another, real low key name. What is Karl Anthony Towns right now in Minnesota?
He's someone a lot of people want to put in the trade machine.
He really is, man. Like that, but also weirdly, and I could say this as I grew up a Knicks fan. I know many Knicks fans. I don't have a group chat of them like you do with your Philly guys, but everybody, every time that it's like, oh, we got to get, you know, the Kentucky connection and you get Towns to New York, and it's like people want to throw their bodies in front of that. They're like, no. Like, we need a star, but like not that one, because when Towns has been in the playoffs, it's like, you know, fouled a ton and hasn't, you know, been able to control series. Now he's also been the underdog in like almost all of the postseason matchups that he's had, but there's a sense of it not, it's like the numbers and the impact don't necessarily match up in terms of what he's been. And like all NBA player, like arguably and certainly by his own accounting, the greatest shooting big man of all time and so on and so forth. But like, the whole gamble last year for Minnesota was, we have a top tier offense with Kat and Anthony Edwards, and we're going to graft on a top tier defense just by bringing in Rudy Gobert. And almost every iteration of that team last year, which dealt with a lot of injuries, and so especially with Towns and a lot of back and forth, like none of it worked quite right. The only time that the Wolves looked something like a real dangerous team was when the ball was in Ant's hands, and where he became an all-star and he became a number one playmaker and the kind of guy who could be the featured guy on Team USA in an off-year tournament and all that kind of stuff. And so now we go back to the drawing board, and not only are those principles back, also Naz Reid is back, and they're going to be doing a lot of like him at power forward and two big lineups, and Chris Finch is going to have to figure it out again. Like I find myself really just not confused, that's not really the right word, but like wondering what's the end game for Kat here. Because if the goal, if things don't pan out in Minnesota, they are not going to be able to trade Gobert for value. You're not going to trade Ant because Ant's the future. The pathway to recouping the picks that you sent out in the Gobert trade and finding yourself a lifeline forward is Kat. But also, what's the market for Kat around the league if people look at all this and say, if this guy's so good, why aren't the teams ever good? You know, if this guy's so good and such an important high impact player, why do we not believe that his teams are ever going to go anyplace? I've always had the connection in my brain between Kat and Trae Young, where I'm like, I've seen these guys put up numbers, I've seen these guys break down defenses, but I've also seen Trae Young get a team to the conference finals, and I've never seen Karl Towns put a scare into anybody serious. Except for
the Dominican Republic national team to the second round of FIBA World Cup.
Well, okay, so yeah, maybe we're on an upward trajectory there. But yeah, so when I say all that, I will grant that that's a kind of a mishmash of just random thoughts. Like, where do you see Kat in that hierarchy? I mean, do you see him as somebody that's like a legitimate game changer for another team in the league? Do you see him as somebody where It's like, are you just going to put him into the trade machine because you kind of can't figure out who else to put in there? Like, where is Kat in your, I guess, you know, when you think about the stars around the league?
Personally, I definitely am a fan of him. I mean, I first saw Karl-Anthony Towns in 2013 at the Mary Klein Classic, a little youth event that Alex Klein put together in honor of his mother who passed away of cancer. He used to raise a lot of money for charity and flew in prospects from all over the country. And this dude won the dunk contest and the three-point shootout. And I was a little fat freshman interning at Slam Magazine, and there's a picture somewhere online if people want to find it, a fat me with a bad haircut interviewing Kat in 2013, 2 years before the draft, and saying this guy's gonna be the number one pick in the draft. So I've always believed.
Also, out there on the internet, don't just find a picture of me now and say fat young Jake Fisher. That would be mean. That would be cruel. You just take a screenshot of me today and be like, I found it. That would be rude.
You're too old to be ever be considered young. So yeah, I mean, the Timberwolves have door A and door B, where like door A is this thing works perfectly and Kat's an all-star again. And I mean, the stuff that I think is really interesting is that Chris Finch, the head coach of the Timberwolves, was definitely someone who's been credited for helping Denver figure out ways to utilize Nikola Jokic out on the perimeter back when Finch was an assistant for the Nuggets. So, and I mean, also like during his time coaching in England and elsewhere and in the G League with RGV, just like Nick Nurse, like those guys, their bread and butter is small ball. So it's just to see them be able to use Towns like a shooter and not just a 7-footer. I think there's dynamism there that you want when he can in theory be pulling away a big from the basket to do that stuff. I just, from a trade value standpoint, a lot of it's going to be dependent on health and performance this season. As cliche as it is to say, people are putting him in the trade machine for exactly what you said, because of, you know, you're not going to be able to get value on Gobert. You're not going to be thinking about trading away Anthony Edwards. But that doesn't just mean like this guy's going to be in trade rumors all year if they're winning games and things are going well, you know? So I talked to Kat in a little scrum when the Wolves were here last Saturday to play the Knicks pregame. I was the only reporter in Chris Finch's pregame press conference.
So no way.
I got some stuff coming sometime on Yahoo Sports. I have to make some other background calls and figure out some more things there. But to me, this the most interesting dynamic is that their payroll is going to be super pricey regardless of who's there when you factor in Ant's contract, Rudy Gobert's contract, and Jaden McDaniels' upcoming contract. So that's the bigger, you know, wrinkle in all this Timberwolves stuff to me. It's the money of it all as much as how good these players actually are and how well they fit together, just because of the new CBA landscape that we're in, which is like something that all these rebuilding teams are going to have to think about. And then my next two guys on my list are from Houston and OKC. I'll go Jalen Green first. Like, it's a downside of rebuilding now. If you get all these guys, like the Thunder, but also like the Rockets have, where you know they paid Fred VanVleet, they paid Dylan Brooks, they're probably going to have to pay Jalen Green and Jabari Smith and go down the list. The Jalen Green thing, like how much he gets paid, will he be an automatic Anthony Edwards LaMelo Ball? We're slapping a $200 million Supermax on you, or not Supermax, Max, because I don't think Jalen is trending in that way with all-star nods and whatnot yet. Don't think he would really be in position to this year with Dylan Brooks and Fred VanVleet being there. But if he is, like, holy hell, would that be a turnaround? And look, Rockets fans tried to bury me online when I reported that the coaching staff or the front office was asking coaching candidates which of Jalen Green, Jabari Smith, or Alperen Sengun, like, should this team be thinking about trading to consolidate and improve and whatever. And Jalen Green was his precious prize jewel. Of all Rockets fans, Jalen Green was one of the worst players in the NBA from an efficiency standpoint. He just was. And he has all the talent to not be. The defense has been, you know, what it is. The offensive side, I think, is where the clear improvements can be, especially with the table setter point guard like Fred VanVleet, that, you know, there was all this stuff. I wrote about the trade of Kevin Porter Jr. yesterday. Let's just not to disregarded, but let's just put all the off-court stuff aside for the sake of speaking about basketball. Like, just toggling back and forth between KPJ and Jalen Green and on the perimeter, like, there wasn't really a real clear pathway for him to kind of become Bradley Beal 2.0. So can Fred VanVleet be the John Wall to Jalen Green's Bradley Beal for a little while? Maybe. But how high he soars, how high he leaps, because he can jump out the gym. Can he actually become like something closer to Zach LaVine than the idea of Zach LaVine? And then from there, as we've talked about, like, Zach LaVine then leaves you more to be desired, right? Like, that's to say, like, there's many rungs up the ladder that I think Jalen Green needs to be getting to. And this is not like, I'm not killing the dude because I think he's bad. It's just, I want him to be good. Like, this is what needs to be done in order to be living up to the billing of being the number two pick in the NBA draft, which, you know, we have seen guys not get there. We've seen Otto Porter just turn into a really good complimentary piece. Evan Turner, like, we're going on year three now. There's winning expectations. You got a new head coach who, by all accounts, is like super invested in making Jalen happen. So will it happen? That's kind of been my theme of all my guys. Like, will what you say or what the people expectations are of you, will it come to fruition?
Yeah. And if you, on that, you know, that aspect of things going from Bradley Beal 2.0, what about Bradley Beal 1.0? Because the Phoenix Suns made you could not beat the price to bring Bradley Beal in, but you onboard that gigantic contract, you commit yourself to, you know, the luxury tax hell that they're going to be in. You do it for a particular reason. You do it for right now. You do it because when you got to the end of your second round series against the Nuggets, as you just mentioned, your offense was Devin Booker and Kevin Durant and, you know, throw your hands up and pray. And Chris Paul, as important as he was to the, you know, elevation of the Suns as a franchise, could not rely on him to consistently stay healthy, clearly had lost a step in terms of his offensive impact within that structure, and had ceded primacy in terms of ball handling and shot creation and everything else to Booker and KD. And so you bring in Bradley Beal, who gives you replicates some of that, like, duplication or overlap of mid-range skill and, you know, the pick and roll pull-up jumpers and all that kind of stuff, but also gives you a ton more downhill pressure at the rim, which is something that the Suns really haven't had the last several years. Like, they very rarely attack the basket. He's much better at getting there and finishing than Chris Paul, than Landry Shamet, who went out in that deal. He's a bona fide all-star scorer, shot creator, a guy that if you are trying to limit, if you're selling out to limit Book, if you're selling out to limit KD, now there's another real answer. That answer obviously has to stay healthy. That answer has to stay on the court. That answer is going to have to play full-time point guard, which he's never done. In fits and starts in Washington, but a little bit of a different ball game here, where these games are going to be, you know, of greater consequence, and there's going to be more pressure on Bradley Beal than there's been in a few years. But this is what the Suns are looking for. They want to win a championship right now, and they made a pretty big bet to signify that they think that Bradley Beal is the guy that can elevate them to that level. Now Bradley Beal has to fit, you know, get in where he fits in as the third guy on that team, and also produce at a level that we haven't seen from him in a few years, and we haven't seen from him in big games past the second round ever. Even in the second round in a handful of years. So I think he could wind up playing a giant role in what an expected finals team or expected Final Four team, how far they get and whether or not they fall short of expectations.
We haven't seen Chet Holmgren play a regular season NBA game. That is my final guy. I think I've said this on the show. I might have even said it last week when we talked about Wembanyama. I was not a fan of Chet Holmgren coming out of the draft. I don't think he sucked. I didn't think he was Victor Wembanyama like people were talking about him as. The Thunder definitely were a team last year that were playing and being organized like a team that was waiting for him to come. And there are plenty of people around the NBA, plenty of talent evaluators who actually do that for a living. I do not. I do not watch college basketball anymore, like I alluded to earlier, who were basically saying to me, I'm a moron and Chet Holmgren should have obviously been the number one pick. Paolo Banchero looks pretty damn good, but like the expectations are still there. And I'm just as much as the Wemby watch is going to be on, as much as there's going to be specialized content highlighting him on San Antonio and everything on Yahoo and everywhere else, I'm just as intrigued to see Chet, because they are cut from a similar cloth of 7-something, super skinny, perimeter skill set, while also being a rim protector. You know, stretch fives don't grow on trees and actually like do it well. You know what I mean? So I just want to see it after a year. Will he follow in the Ben Simmons, Blake Griffin long line of guys who suffered a season-ending injury and came back and just were ready to go right away and won Rookie of the Year? And then you got Donovan Mitchell, or it was Malcolm, I forget who it was complaining that Ben shouldn't have won it.
It was Mitchell. Like, it was the Utah fan base, maybe more than Mitchell.
But yeah.
Yeah, he had a hoodie that said that with the definition of rookie on it. I remember that.
Yeah. So will that happen again? I don't know. The Thunder are going to be good, though. I keep saying it. Maybe I'm saying it too much. Maybe I'm going to be putting myself in an old takes exposed position. But I'm bullish on the Thunder, mostly because of everyone not named Chet. Like, I'm not saying I don't think Chet is good. I don't think he'll be good. But I'm so high on Shea and Giddy and Jalen Williams that I'm just, if he is the upper echelon of what people's expectations are for Chet, damn, does the Western Conference just have a whole nother wrinkle that, you know, I think a lot of teams that expect to compete for home court advantage in the playoffs are going to miss the playoffs and be stuck in the play-in like altogether. So if the Thunder really are there, it's probably because of many things, but also that Chet Holmgren has been what was promised. I want to see what happens.
One note on Chet before I get to my last guy, because plug, I wrote about the Thunder as one of my 5 most interesting teams at the beginning of the week. And you mentioned them sort of being a team that felt like it was put together last year and just sort of like a placeholder waiting for Chet. In addition to just them wanting to play five out, they had all their centers were shooters. They wanted to have that in terms of the spacing on the floor for Shea to drive. They were 18th in terms of how frequently opponents shot at the basket. They were 22nd in blocks per game. They were 28th in defensive rebounding rate, and they were dead last in second chance points allowed. They are a team that was desperate for rim protection, desperate for somebody to cover the paint and to just hold up at that end of the floor. If you can clear rebounds, you can start the fast break. If you can block shots, you can get out in transition. All of the things that they sort of had a harder time with them, because they were a middle of the pack defense without any real rim protection, without an interior deterrent. You crank that up, you allow those perimeter defenders to get a little bit more, play a little tighter on the perimeter. Maybe that's a top 10 defense, and maybe all of a sudden you're looking at an opportunity for a team to make another rise of that, of the standings there, go from the play-in to the playoff, as we've talked about. If that's going to happen, somebody in the West, as you said, might have to tumble down. I don't know that it's going to be the Memphis Grizzlies, but I think that my last guy is a particular person of interest there. It's Ja Morant.
Oh, is he?
Oh, yeah. I mean, whomst among us has heard that name recently? We're recording this on Wednesday the 18th. Earlier this morning, ESPN, Baxter Holmes, and Tim McMahon put out a big piece about the last 18 months of Ja Morant's life.
Which I have not read. I want the record to be clear. I have no idea what is in that article.
Yeah. I did read it. I'm not going to quote from it or anything, but I'll just note it underscores that it's been a pretty hectic year and a half for Morant and for the Grizzlies organization. Obviously, the last time that we saw the second half of last season after the All-Star break, the multiple incidents of flashing a gun on Instagram Live, the suspension, the 11 or so day stay at a Florida facility that Morant has been adamant was not a rehab. The brief comeback and then the first round playoff series where he gets injured and they go out pretty quietly to the Lakers, followed by the summertime punishment and the 25-game suspension. So Ja Morant is going to sort of loom over the Grizzlies for the first 25 games of this season. And so that's why, I mean, I'm interested in the Grizzlies. Like, I'm a fan of what they've put together, and I'm interested in that organization and that team. I could have picked a number of guys here. Like, in Ja's absence, what Desmond Bain can give you becomes even more important. Is he sort of taking that next step to all-star status as does he go from, the low 20s in points per game up to 25? Does he take on more ball handling and facilitating role in his absence? Is Jaren Jackson Jr., after winning Defensive Player of the Year, but then having a really rough time of it in FIBA play, Is he somebody who's going to be able to, you know, level up again and become more consistently a viable offensive player, which sometimes he's been sort of in and out while continually bringing the defense. Marcus Smart as the newcomer there and a guy who is going to be expected to kind of replace what Dylan Brooks gave you as the number one perimeter defender, but also a super experienced veteran that's well respected and be able to kind of calm things down after everything kind of went haywire in the second half of last year. But to me, no matter what any of those guys or, you know, the myriad players who could be the small forward on this team, from Zaire Williams to David Roddy to Jake LaRavia to whoever, so much of it just comes back to what Morant is when he comes back. Whatever flow you establish in the first 25 games of the season is necessarily going to be impacted by the arrival of one of the highest usage, highest time of possession, most electric ball handlers in the league. Is Ja also going to be able to, you know, get comfortable playing like that again after? The hope is that some things have changed for him or some things have adjusted for him. A, has anything changed? Has anything adjusted for him? B, if it has, does that have any impact on his on-court game? C, what does any of that mean for what the Grizzlies hope to be? Because they've been a spread pick and roll, him downhill, shooters on, around the perimeter. Like, what can they be with him back in the lineup? And then if you are, 10-15 or lower, if they have a really rough first 25 games, are we talking about a team that's been, home court advantage in the West the last couple of years, suddenly dropping down the standings? And what does that mean for the whole building project in Memphis? I feel like Ja hangs over all of it to me because there's the question of, like, what are you without him? He now has forced you to answer that question for the first 25 games. And what are you when he comes back? Can you kind of dovetail those things together to be the best version of this Grizzlies team that we've seen so far? I think the potential is there for that. But I think there's also a significant potential downside that this time last year we weren't considering. We didn't see it as a potential downside there. So, yeah. I mean, again, I know these are chalky names, but they're pretty big names, Jake. You got to give me that.
Well, the answer Memphis used to have when Ja wasn't there was, let's just slide Tyus Jones, the best backup point guard in the league, right, up one rung. He's no longer there. The answer to what Dan will do when I'm not here is coming up shortly. But first, he had a nice conversation with Shea Serrano. Dan, take it away.
Joining the show now is an illustrious guest. He is a best-selling author. He is the creator of Primo on Amazon Freevee. He's the writer of Miguel Likes to Fight on Hulu. He's a social media icon. He is here today to promote Six Trophies, a new weekly NBA podcast for Wondery Media that he's doing with my friend Jason Concepcion. He is my buddy. He is my former coworker. He is Shea Serrano. Shea, what's good, man? It's great to see you. How you doing?
What up, my boy? You look so handsome with this new haircut.
Oh, thank you, Shea. I mean, right back at you. I feel like we're starting at a place of mutual respect and admiration, which is why I want to give you an opportunity right up front here. When we were coworkers at The Ringer, you once commented on a picture of me by saying, and I quote, "You look like the kind of English teacher who says that Shakespeare was the first rapper." Would you like to take this opportunity to publicly apologize to me for that kind of slander?
It was accurate. Whoever's doing the video for this, please, right now, can we see the picture? Because that was 100% what you looked like in that photo. Also handsome as well.
So no apologies. Okay, so now we're not on that same.
Double down on it.
When in doubt, double down. Six Trophies just launched with Wondery Media. I've had a couple of episodes now. It's the latest in a long line of things that you've worked on with Jason over the years. Blog posts from Grantland and The Ringer up to podcasts to writing for film and television. What do you like about working with Jason? Why did you want to focus that kind of dynamic specifically on the NBA with this project?
I like working with Jason because he's smarter than I am and he's funnier than I am. And my whole career philosophy has always been, let me just be around people who are better than I am at something. And then I let them do their thing. And everybody goes, "Oh, great job, Shea. Way to go." You know what I mean? you've talked to Jason on numerous occasions. He's super smart. He's super funny. And also, I know that he loves the NBA. He loves basketball in general as much as I do. So when we got to talking about wanting to do a basketball show, Jason was one of the, was like, "Well, we should try and see if we can get this guy to work on it."
Well, you picked an auspicious time to do it. You are a San Antonio Spurs fan.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
We've reached the onset of a new age in Spurs basketball with the arrival of Victor Wembanyama. And I guess my main question for you as a Spurs fan is, how dare you? This is your Spurs fandom and professional life here has gone from Robinson to Duncan to Kawhi to Wemby. Where do you get off?
Man, I get off on a bus headed for another championship trophy. That's where I get off. Man, when we drafted Wemby, or when we got that pick, I just remember watching them do the cards, right? Watching them, like, the guy up on stage going through, I'm sitting there going, and they get down to whatever the final 13 are or something like that. And you're just like, I remember him opening the first one, and I'm sitting on the couch, as me, as my wife Laramie, as my youngest son, and we're sitting there watching, and he does the first one. And when he did the first one, I just said, don't do it. Don't do it. Like, I didn't want to see the Spurs logo on there. And he does it, and it wasn't Spurs logo. And I was like, well, shoot, I got it. I'm going to do this now. Every single time he opens an envelope. And I did the same. Like, I held my hands in the same position. And right before he would open it, I go, don't do it. Don't do it. I say it twice just like that. And it was working all the way through. I couldn't believe it was working. I was so excited. I was like, there's no way that this is about to happen. We're talking about Victor Wembanyama, one of the person who everybody was saying this could potentially be the greatest draft pick in the history of team sports, was essentially what they were arguing. And when he did that second to last card, I felt a little bit bad for Charlotte, like a small amount of bad, because you saw him when he opened it, and like at the angle you saw the turquoise on there, the teal on there, and you're like, holy like I was jumping on the couch and screaming and yelling. There was still a part of me that was like, is he overhyped? Is he oversold? It might be. And then he had his first preseason game against the Heat, and he did like four things that have never been done on a basketball court before. Right. And you're like, oh my God, he's real. He's real. Like, he could be the thing. He could be the thing. And Dan, I felt so good. I felt so good, Dan Devine. I felt divine.
Aw. Well, first off, professional writer, I appreciate that about you. But I understand that. I respect it. Is it hard to stay patient with it, though? Like, now you see that it actually looks the way it says on the box, right? Like, you're like, oh my God, it actually does translate this way. Are you immediately, you know, planning the parade route again? Are you looking at Pop, like, finding a six finger? You know, like, or are you like, no, it's going to have to take some time. Like, how hard is it to sort of not expect it all at once?
It's not that hard, because we have, for what, the past 4 or 5 years, we've won an average of 30 games. Last season was 22 right. games. Like, if we do 36 games this season, that's going to feel real good. But also, just watching that first preseason game, or even the summer league game, like during the actual summer league in San Antonio, it was a thing of like, all right, we need to be home at this time, because we're going to play. We played the Hornets. We're going to play the Charlotte Hornets in a summer league game, and we need to all watch it. Like, that was the thing that was happening. There was somebody, I can't remember who it was, who mentioned it during the draft night. And they were like, San Antonio, we knew that we had the first pick. We're just getting ready to do it. And I can't remember who this person was, but he was like, what Victor Wembanyama does is now every time there's a home game in San Antonio, it's going to be a party. It's going to be like a party in the streets. 41 nights out of the year next season, it's going to be a party. And so right now, like, that's all we're really looking forward to. That's all we're excited about. And they have been very upfront from the beginning. You know, Vic is on a 4 to 5 year timetable. That's what we're doing here. So you just set your expectations for that. And, you know, we're not going to win a championship this season, but what will happen is he will do what he did in that Miami Heat game, which he would, a couple of times this year, is going to do something we've never seen on a basketball court. And that feels real good. It feels real good.
I don't blame you for feeling good about it. Although I do have one sort of follow-up question to that is, your first reaction when you found out Devin Vassell was getting $146 million, was it the same level of good? Or was it like, is it a roughly equivalent? Like, where was that at?
I was like, that's a lot of money for Devin. I'm happy for Devin. Oh, that, then I remembered, oh, we got the new contract, the new CBA thing is happening. Okay, this averages out to like, it's smaller than it seems,
right,
based on what's coming, you know what I mean?
And then I'm guessing thought three was, I got to go talk to the people at Wondery because the number needs to go up. Like, if Vassell's getting 146, up. I gotta level it up.
Yeah, exactly.
Back to Six Trophies, which has been a very, very fun listen the first couple of episodes. I made a point of getting the second one in this morning because I'm a professional like that. You and Jason mentioned on your first episode that you went through like a ton of potential trophies. The conceit of the show is you hand out six big trophies and six small trophies to stories of the week, you know, news of the important happenings in the league, and things that you find fun and interesting. You said that you went through like a ton of potential trophy names before whittling it down to those main six. Were there any like particular favorites that just missed the cut? Like, you got to kill your darling sometimes when you write. Were there ones that you can recall that were like, I wish there was a spot for this, but it just kind of doesn't really work for what we're looking for?
So the way the show works is we have six trophies that are the same every single week, right? The Denzel Washington and Training Day trophy, which is essentially who had the best week, who had the best performance of the week. The Lauryn Hill, you might win some, but you just lost one trophy. Which is like who had the worst performance. In this case, it was Dylan Brooks, who getting ejected less than 5 minutes into his first game as Houston Rocket. But we had those six. We had to figure out what are like six tent pole themes we can have every week that will allow us to talk about as much of the scope of the NBA as possible, right? So we're figuring those out. So yeah, we went through, I would guess, like 100 different trophies when we were just typing the names into the Google Doc that Jason and I had. Some of the ones that I like and that will eventually get used, because we have another section at the end of the podcast. It's the little trophies, and those ones change every week, and you can do whatever you want. Right, but like the Henry Hill and Goodfellas, Karen, why did you do that, Karen? Like that trophy for somebody who just like did a thing that you were like, why would you do that? Right. Well, you know what I mean? Like, or the Mr. Belding and Saved by the Bell. Hey, what is going on here? Like, remember when he would say that? Like, it was so much the Ryan Gosling and Drive trophy, which was just like, we just give this to someone who did something really, really cool. The Anton Chigurh, what's the most you ever lost on a coin toss trophy? The Liam Neeson, I have a very particular set of skills trophy. The Don Draper, that's what the money's for trophy. Like it becomes like a goofy thing to work on because it's just fun to just like say something. You just make up a name for a trophy and then figure out something to plug in, a story to plug in after it. But yeah, we went through. So many. We also recorded a bunch of practice episodes and tried different trophies out in there and figure out what works and what doesn't work. And I really like the way that it ended up turning out.
So let that be a lesson to you, everybody listening, who thinks it's just you get on with a friend and you crack the mics. A lot goes into this. A lot goes into the legwork of putting together something as precisely calibrated as six trophies.
Yeah, it always surprises me how much you have to do, because you, the best podcasts, you listen to them and you're like, oh, this is just some friends hanging out, chit-chatting it up. And you don't realize the way that you make it sound like that is you have 18 pages of research that you've right. done to talk about the thing. Like you gotta have that part of it.
Well, one of my aspects of research, and you try to like double dip, if you do something for writing, you see if you can do it with the podcast too. This week we're running a series that I'm writing called Five Most Interesting Teams, just teams that I find
particularly familiar.
You remember?
I read the New Orleans one.
Oh, thank you. So you're the one. All right. So we're running that series all week. I got a couple more of those. And I'm wondering, as I go through that, outside of the Spurs, which, you know, we've established and we've talked about a little bit, is there a team that is of particular interest to you as you head into the season? Like, just the place they find themselves, a particular, you know, player or storyline, one team that really jumps off the page that you're going to want to keep an eye on over the course of the season?
There are, of course, the main ones that everybody's going to watch Milwaukee because you want to see right. Dame, and everybody's going to watch Denver, and everybody's going to watch the Lakers. But some of the ones who are away from that conversation that I have found myself really invested in, for some reason, we just mentioned the Charlotte Hornets. I really like the Hornets. I really like LaMelo. I'm really curious to see what that team does this season. I'm curious to see what happens with Sacramento. Do they fall back a little bit? Do they take a step forward a little bit? Like, it can go either way, it feels like, with that team. Portland, I think, is really interesting. I'm really rooting for Scoot. I really want him to be good. I really like Portland just as a place to visit. Those are probably like the three teams that I'm going to watch on League Pass, separate of like a bit. It didn't even have to be a big game. Like, I'm going to be excited to tune in when Charlotte is playing on a Tuesday, see what's going on.
Well, you're also, it allows you to be like a real magnanimous winner, where you're like, I'm really interested in y'all who didn't get Wemby. Like,
you're so close. Oh, man.
And like, you know, I support you. Like, I see you didn't get it, but like, I love you still and I support you. And I'm going to show up on that Tuesday night on League Pass. And then I'm going to turn you off to watch the main event when he's on local time for me.
Oh, man. I'm so excited. Dan, you have no idea. I got more texts during the Miami Heat preseason game about Wemby than I did when my first two children were born. We had twins. The first kids, we had a set of twins, and I got more texts about Wemby than I did when they were birthed into the world. Oh, man.
A couple more, Shay, and then we'll get you out of here. I know you are a busy man. I don't often talk to people who are just profiled in GQ, so we'll try to move through circumstances here. Everyone's got a guy, an archetypal guy that they just kind of fall for every time and they can't quit. You know, in the NBA, that often turns into like switchable wings, but they can't shoot, or point guards who are flashy for no reason, even if it's not like the most reasonable play for them to make. What's Shea Serrano's favorite kind of guy? The guy that he can't quit when it comes to NBA stuff?
Oh, you know who I love? I know exactly. As soon as you started talking, I'm telling you exactly who I love. I love a big guy. I love a big guy in the paint.
Just a huge dude.
Just a huge dude who can't quite put it together. When you're like, man, like, you should be the next Shaq. Like Andrew Bynum. What happened? He had it. I love a Michael Olowokandi, just down there in the paint, banging around, fighting around. I love those kind of players. Probably because it's like the thing of how all the guards want to be big guys and how the big guys want to be guards. Like, that's not necessarily true in the way it was in the 90s or early 2000s when those were very separate positions. I'm 5'7". Like, what would it be like to be 7'2" and have shoulders as wide as an office desk and just like just power, just raw power down there? You see someone like Shaq and you're like, man, that's incredible. I've been waiting for so long for the next Shaq. I don't think he's ever going to show up again. But I love a big guy. I love the big players down. That's why Asia Wilson is my favorite player in the WNBA, because she's a big player. She just bangs down low, just wants to fight all the time.
Well, along those lines, not saying that Asia Wilson would be considered a villain, but in your book, Basketball and Other Things, you inducted 13 players into the Basketball Villain Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. At the time of your publication, there was one player who was still playing, and that was Meta World Peace. That's a few years ago now. Yeah. I'm wondering if you were to update the list, is there a current player that you think, you know, would be worthy of introduction into that kind of Hall of Fame?
Draymond. Because here's the thing. You can't just be like a pest. You can't just be an irritant. Like, there's got to be accolades behind it.
Right.
To be like a proper marquee name and lights basketball villain, there's got to be some success attached to your villainy. You can't be like Dylan Brooks doesn't qualify. He's an irritant. He's a pest. But he's not a villain. Like, he gave himself the nickname Dylan the Villain or whatever. But Draymond Green is a villain, because Draymond Green has on four occasions now stood at the top of the mountain and thrown lightning bolts down at all of the people he has defeated along the way. Like, he stole something from other players. You know what I mean? He didn't let the Kevin Durant get a championship with OKC. And he didn't let, and he stopped like LeBron the first time in Cleveland. And he stopped like, You need that. You need like a Bill Laimbeer kind of resume to be a good, proper villain. I'm glad you brought up Basketball and Other Things. That book is old now. What, 2017 is when it came out? So I was working on that one 2016, 2015. And that was when I really started finding all of the Dan Devine articles. and like, I tweeted about this a couple of weeks ago, but I want to make sure I say it out loud. Like, I think right now you're the most underrated basketball writer working in the country today. Like, when you read a Dan
John
Devine
Gennaro,
piece.
Cut all this out.
When I read a Dan Devine piece, I know it's going to have all of the information in there that I'm hoping to find in a basketball story. You know what I mean? And it's never going to be, you never read a Dan Devine piece and find a sentence in there that is like, this is a crass thing to say. I'm going to say a crass thing, right? But you never find a sentence that feels like it's trying to suck its own D, if that makes sense. It's like, it's never like, look at me, Dan Devine. You know what I mean? And that's hard to do. That's hard to do. And so I just wanted to make sure I said it out loud, because I don't think I've ever said that to you. I've said it in text or an email whatever. But out loud with my mouth, I want to say Dan Devine. Incredible basketball writer. I always get excited when a new Dan Devine piece comes out. You're doing great work, man.
This is preposterous to have happen on microphone and camera. It's very kind of you. I'm not sure how much of that part people will hear, especially the part about verbing your own noun. But we'll do what we can to try to get that publishable and get it in there. And now, honestly, if I feel, you know, completely ludicrous moving from that very kind thing that you said to this completely silly thing is the last question I've got for you. Mm. But it's on the rundown. You know, we talked about the 18 pages of research and it's here. So we're going to do it. President Joe Biden and Commissioner Adam Silver call you into a meeting, Shea Serrano. It's a secret meeting, and they give you the secret of time control technology. In this meeting, they tell you that you are allowed to pluck one player out of NBA history at the particular peak of their powers and drop that player into today's NBA. Who are you going back to get, and who are we going to watch from the past perform in the modern NBA?
Oh, my God. I know exactly who I'm going to say, because this was a thing I've thought about a bunch. I think I pitched a version of this one time.
Can I tell you, I had the feeling that this is something that not only would you not be thrown off by the question, but you'd be like, I'm so glad somebody finally asked me this. I've been thinking about this for 20 years.
When we were at the Ringer, you know, they do the thing where we would like gather and talk about basketball ideas at the start of the season. Mm-hmm. And so I'd always have like a list of things that I'd work on to be like, this is the stuff I'm going to pitch when we go to that. And one of the things on there was a once a month column called Better Birthday. And it's like, if we could change the birthday of one NBA player to get them to play during a different period, who would it be? And the one player who made me think of that, the one who I wanted to write about the most, the one who I think if we drop him into today's NBA, you can fucking forget about it. It's a wrap. Give me 7'1", the Admiral, Big Dave, David Robinson, who was like, he's you know, playing against Shaq and Patrick Ewing and Hakeem Olajuwon. Hakeem Olajuwon would also be great for this, but Dave was just so fast and so athletic and so built to run and move on offense like the way that bigs move on offense today versus what they were doing in the mid 90s or whatever. He shows up in the early 90s and draft him in the late 80s. But yeah, I would love to see David Robinson in today's NBA. I think he'd be so good. I think he'd be so incredibly perfect.
Well, unfortunately, you're going to have to settle for the current version of the Spurs, which feature an almost like a create a player level of unbelievable thing that is real and is out on your team now. And in bidding farewell to you, we'll say goodbye to an officer and a gentleman, Shea Serrano. He's not the admirable. He's not the admiral, but he's admirable. Shay, you got to go out when you're done listening to this. Please listen to this. But then after that, go to the Wondery app. Go to wherever you get your podcast. Listen to Six Trophies with Shea Serrano and Jason Concepcion. It's absolutely a delight. And it's a delight to see you and get to speak with you today, sir. Thanks so much for making some time for us here on No Cap Room.
Yeah, baby.
That's going to do it for this episode of No Cap Room. If you would like more of Dan talking to people before our next episode, subscribers to Ball Don't Lie will be treated to the first episode of a brand new show called Divine Intervention. Dan, I believe I am the original namer of this. I think I threw out, put these two words together as a theoretical podcast segment for this show. Now it has spun off into its own program. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I'm going to have an NBA podcast. Imagine that. The general idea is a self-help podcast about basketball. I'm going to have other people on to talk about their favorite teams, talk about the things that they have big feelings about and they're in the NBA. We're going to hopefully find a different way of covering the league than we do here on No Cap Room or that Vinny Goodwill does on The Good Word with Goodwill. We're going to try to have a good time with it. It's going to be fast-paced. It's going to be a little bit of a different thing. Some more segments, some more games, ideally. Different things that we can try to do, and maybe a little bit more in my voice. Not that you don't get enough of me here, but maybe slightly different. And, you know, Jake has to be shackled to me here, but, you know, this is an opportunity for me to sort of explore the studio space a little bit differently. So Divine Intervention is going to start next week, and we're going to keep going after that. So you'll have that on the Ball Don't Lie feed. If you're subscribed to that already, you're going to get that too. And if you're not, please do.
So now it's official. This is my show. You are now my right. Co-host.
Exactly right. Which is always the way that I've felt about it. I've always considered it to be like, you know, you're the first chair, I'm the second chair, never the twain shall meet. And then we're going to see what it looks like when, you know, I'm in that spot on another show. So wish me luck, Jake.
No, we've been doing this together, but I'm excited to listen to you from afar as much as I do up close, just like this.
I was going to say, there's a note in our rundown that says, Jake, colon, I can't wait to listen. And I got to be honest, I think it feels like a lie. It feels like a lie to me.
I listen to every... Just like I hope everyone else who subscribes, I listen to every episode that comes through on the Ball Don't Lie podcast feed. So we hope that you keep doing that for us, for Vinny Goodwill Show, for Divine Intervention. And yeah, that's really all we have to say. Thank you to Shay Serrano for joining us earlier in the pod. Go subscribe to Six Trophies to hear him and Jason Concepcion cover the NBA in their own unique way. Thanks to John Gennaro for doing all the things he does to make the show look and sound great. Follow us on the various social media platforms that still exist. I am at Jake L. Fisher. That is at Your Man Divine. Subscribe to Ball Don't Lie on YouTube or whatever podcast platform you're currently listening on, and leave us a 5-star review. We thank you for listening, and we'd appreciate it if you came back again next week for another episode. No Cap Room.